This episode of To The Journey is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for your smartphone, tablet and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international programme of the non-profit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org.
Hi, this is Robert Duncan McNeil, also known as Tom Paris from Star Trek Voyager. You're listening to Trek FM.
I think it's safe to say that no one on this crew has been more obsessed with getting home than I have. But when I think about everything we've been through together, maybe it's not the destination that matters. Maybe it's the journey. And if that journey takes a little longer, so we can do something we all believe in, I can't think of any place I'd rather be, or any people I'd rather be with.
To the journey.
You're here.
To the journey.
Hi everyone at home and welcome. This is To The Journey. I'm your co-host Kay Shaw, and with me as always are
Zachary Frueling and
Suzanne Williamson.
So tonight we are going to do something that we haven't done before. We're going to do an episode comparison between the Voyager episode Real Life and the Next Generation episode The Offspring.
Wait, aren't these the two episodes where Data has a holographic daughter and the Doctor has a robot family?
Yeah, that's...
Do I have that backwards?
Broadly right, yeah.
Kind of, but not really.
I was getting these two episodes confused. They're so similar to each other.
They are, and yet they're not at the same time.
With both, you need a box of tissues to get through the end.
You do need a box of tissues, and I feel I ought to apologize to both of you, because when I suggested this as an idea, it seemed great. And then as I was wailing myself through both of these episodes, I thought, you guys are not going to be particularly happy with me.
Yeah, they're kind of a downer, Kay. Nice job.
Yeah, don't do this to a pregnant lady.
Yeah, sorry.
My hormones are all over the place to begin with. I cry at the drop of a hat. And this was just awful.
I was a little surprised, frankly. Before the show, you guys both told me that these episodes are tearjerkers for you guys. And for me, they're sad, of course. But they didn't cause any tears, I have to admit.
Oh, heartless.
Yeah.
Does that make me shallow?
Patak.
It makes you hard and cold, to be honest. So, in all seriousness, the reason why I picked these two episodes, I've always kind of seen the parallels with them, but I think it's really interesting to look at essentially the only two artificial intelligence main characters that we've got in Star Trek. Certainly up to now, anyway. Because on the face of it, you'd think that there would be a lot of similarities between them. And there are, in a way, but also they're so different. They're just really, really different. And we get these two episodes from them, which are along the similar theme. That it's about each of them wanting to create themselves a family. And the two episodes are so different, and the tone of how it goes is so different because of the differences between them.
Like, I guess there's this fundamental thing I still feel like I don't understand about the difference between the two. When Data creates Lal and Lal dies, essentially, it's tragic. Mm-hmm. In fact, Picard even tells Data it's a life. It can't be activated and deactivated. But when the Doctor creates a holographic family, even though on Voyager the Doctor comes to be seen as sentient and intelligent and a part of the crew, you know, an artificial life form, why aren't his holographic family perceived that way by the rest of the crew? Why aren't they given the gravitas that Lal was given?
Because they aren't sentient and Lal is. They're like Michael Sullivan, just throwaways.
There's always an implication with the Doctor that over time, as he's kind of experienced things and added to his program and developed himself and learned things, that he's kind of become something more than the rest of the holograms that we see.
But was he like that when he was first created? Like from day one, was he more sentient than your average hologram on day one?
I don't know. To me, he feels like he is. I mean, we know that he's programmed with all the knowledge of, like, all of the best physicians and all this type of thing, and obviously a lot of historical knowledge and things that he can use to apply in his work. So maybe there's some element of that that creates this, like, really strong personality that we see right from the get-go.
I sort of feel like Geoffrey has a pretty extensive knowledge of the Klingon cultural database.
Well, that's because B'Elanna programmed him to.
I was going to say, that was B'Elanna influence. Right,
that is all B'Elanna's fault.
But it always strikes me as funny that the Doctor has kind of earned this extra special hologram status when ostensibly he's just a hologram like any other hologram. Yes, he's developed his abilities, he's modified his program, you know, he is on all the time. But what makes him different from a hologram standpoint? Like, is there an actual substantive change in his program? Are his holographic family literally just, you know, shadows and illusions of people? They're not actually sentient. They're not conscious. They have no autonomous behavior. So they're just mere projections.
Well, certainly they are to begin with. I mean, when he creates his Stepford family at the beginning.
Yes. I love the Stepford family.
You know, they're just, you want to punch all of them, don't you, really?
Bless have them. A nice day, honey.
Yes. I love you, Daddy. Obviously, that's very one-dimensional, and I like what we see there about the fact that he just really doesn't get when B'Elanna first tries to explain to him, when he has them round for dinner and she's trying to explain to him about why this isn't really what you're going to get the most out of doing if you create them like this, and he just doesn't get it. It's like he just doesn't really understand, and when she changes them, he kind of learns what she means by it. I just find that really interesting that he's created this family. He's like, oh, they're all perfect and wonderful.
Well, it's kind of a weird and maybe a little kind of a messed up take on family life. Like, real meaning is found in the struggle and the disharmony as opposed to harmony.
Yeah, but they kind of show both sides of it. Because I like the bit where we get when he has the argument with them all, he tries to kind of do the family meeting and they all storm off. And then Belle's all like sort of cute. I love you anyway, Daddy, even though you messed up. And I just thought that was really cute. And obviously that interaction, when she interacted with him that way, meant more to him. You could see that meant more to him than when they were all being perfect in the beginning.
Well, that was genuine. And I guess That's my question. At that point, when B'Elanna reprogrammed them, did they become the sentient living versions of a family, or are they still mere projections?
They're still mere projections because they're turned off each time he leaves. So they have no chance to better themselves and to become a sentient being.
It's a life, Suzanne. You can't merely activate it and deactivate a hologram.
It's a hologram, Zach. You can deactivate it whenever you want.
See, I don't think there are any nice, neat answers to your question. I think you want a nice, neat answer to your question. Like, yes, there's this very clear set of criteria. After this point, they become sentient. And I don't think that exists. Or if it does, it's not ever been really established.
Well, I guess the thing that doesn't make sense to me is if they're still mere projections, when the daughter, Belle, dies, why is the Doctor sad? If it's just a projection. I guess for the same reason we're sad in watching the episode, I guess, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's the question, isn't it? When you watch it, it's not necessarily you're sad because you think of her as being a real person. Because, I mean, even if you did within the story think of her as a real person, you know, sorry to break this to everyone, but it's only a TV show.
Really?
What?
Yeah, sorry.
No!
How dare you?
But there's something about relating to other people's pain that's just really innately human. And being able to, like, see that and feel the pain that he's going through is obviously what gives you that emotion, even though it's obviously not actually real.
The Doctor was also upset by another holographic death. Don't forget Freya.
Yeah.
And she was just a hologram. So, I mean, he can be upset when his fellow holograms die, especially ones that he feels connected to.
I mean, maybe you're getting at the heart of the genius of Tom's sympathy for what the Doctor's going through. Tom has to kind of counsel him and say, you know, maybe you should experience the pain of the loss. Don't just turn it off. You know, if you really want to be a, you know, one of us, then, you know, experience pain like we do.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, from the Doctor's point of view, I don't think he sees them as any different to the rest of the crew, because he's a hologram and he feels real to himself. So I don't see why he would view them as any less real than the rest of the crew. I don't think he does view them as any less real.
But I guess if he really wants to experience a family, why not create a real family like him with real sentience, just like the Doctor has real sentience? Wouldn't that be a better kind of The stakes are higher because you can't just turn them off if they're real life forms, right? But
we don't know how long it's taken them to develop him previously to the show. Obviously, it's been...
He'd be tying up Holodeck 2 forever.
That is true.
Which would make some people very unhappy, especially when they want to play Captain Proton.
No Captain Proton, no Fairhaven.
They could just install hollow emitters in his quarters.
He doesn't have quarters.
Well, they could give him some and install hollow emitters in them.
It could be like, take your daughter to work day, and, you know, he could just take, you know, put the whole family inside the inside sick bay.
Like, sorry, Harry, you got to give up your quarters. The doctor needs some. You can sleep in the cargo bay.
Right. No, what they could do, because it's like really easy to just like shrink him, he could have them in like a little mini house in the side of sick bay, and then when he goes home, they just shrink him and then he goes.
So in like where they would keep dead bodies? Is that what you mean? Like
no,
the mini
just house? Like on his so desk or something. No,
what is that word?
Not in the mortuary, in his desk or something.
The holographic morgue?
Well, that's the thing that's like on the side of sick bay, the little morgue.
I meant like on his desk. He could have a little mini house. Be cute. Little mini Klingons like walking up and down his desk to visit.
Ooh. Like The Sims?
Yeah, like The Sims, only, you know, 3D on your desk.
Or what's that other one where the alternate life thing?
Second Life.
Second Life.
I played that so much. Oh my gosh.
Did you? I never played it.
So like the doctor would have like a little holographic Second Life thing going on top of his desk?
Yeah. Only it would be his actual life.
The doctor likes short women, you know?
I mean, it depends on how small they shrunk him when they sent him home, I suppose. So to move on a bit to sort of the comparison between the two, the thing that I found interesting to start with is the reasons why both the Doctor and Data go ahead and do what they're doing. And I think they're quite different, which I find quite interesting, because you'd think, oh, you know, it's all this idea of trying to emulate humans, which we do see an element from. More from Data, I think, than from the Doctor. But I still think the Doctor doesn't say he wants to emulate humans. But I think with a lot of things that he does, that is what he's trying to do. But yeah, I find it really, really interesting, because the Doctor says he wants to experience family life and to improve himself that way. But Data expresses this idea of he wants himself to continue.
Data seems really concerned with perpetuating himself. Yeah. And the Doctor, which is weird. You think the Doctor would be concerned about that too, considering how like self-focused the Doctor usually is. You think he'd be more interested in preserving himself.
But the Doctor never believes that he'll die.
No. And also, I think it's a little bit of a different situation, because Data is unique. And I know we see the Doctor as unique because he's like this sentient type of hologram, but there are a lot of other holograms that exist. He's not the only hologram that's knocking around.
There are an awful lot of Mark I's mining dilithium.
Yeah, exactly.
But Data isn't truly unique. And it kind of bugged me when they kept mentioning that, because I'm like, what about Lore? Hello?
Well, is Lore not been deactivated by this point?
He comes back. There was the episode Data Lore. And then the very next season, he comes back again. And then there's B4, which we don't know about yet.
I think it's season 4, though, when Lore finally... Well, no, he doesn't get deactivated. He gets he meets up with Dr. Sung, and then he leaves.
Yeah.
And then...
But at this point...
But we see Lore before this episode.
Yeah, we see him in season 1, I think, don't we?
But he was beamed out into space with the crystalline entity, right?
Yeah, and I think to all intents and purposes at this point, as far as Data is concerned, he's no longer existing, really.
He should know better.
Well, yes, I suppose, but...
He has disowned him as a brother. I have no brother.
He's never had an evil twin before, so he doesn't really know how it goes. Yeah, I do find it really interesting that he has this sense of wanting to perpetuate himself, but it's not... I try to understand where that comes from, because there's not an emotional attachment to that idea. It's more just from a purely kind of practical sense.
But Data really tries to embrace the father role. I mean, he's almost insulted that people aren't treating Lao like a real daughter and treating him like a real father. I mean, yes, we know he's an android. He, you know, in theory, doesn't really feel those emotions. But I think we all agree that that's kind of a, not a facade, but you know, we think there's an emotional undercurrent to Data even before he gets the emotion chip. I think we all
definitely
recognize that. Yeah. And I think he's just bleeding irritation that people don't treat his, you know, newfound familial relationship with more respect.
Even a little bit of animosity towards the captain, Captain Picard. Mm-hmm. And when he says, well, I don't see anyone else coming to you when they want to procreate, asking if it's okay.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, that's right, Data, you go.
You tell him. You tell him. Yeah. It's difficult because I think it puts Picard in a difficult position, but he can see Data's point of view, but he can also see the point of view of the fact that Starfleet are going to be all over it like a rash. And he hasn't really had time to be prepared for that. So it's just he's in a difficult position, I think, more than anything, which I don't think he's really angry with Data. I think he's more angry with the situation.
I think he's angry at first. I mean, this is one of the few instances I can think of Picard being really genuinely flustered when he's like, you know, you might have consulted me
he
first.
He can be very cranky, though, can't he? It's so funny.
He hasn't had enough tea.
No. He needs some more Earl Grey and then he'll be...
Picard actually doesn't deal with the unknown all that well.
Could you imagine that if he'd come in and like had this rant at Data and then Troy had just been like, Captain, have you had your Earl Grey this morning?
It's like, give me an hour, I'll be in a better mood.
It's like Janeway with her coffee, just useless beforehand.
I think it's interesting that we get to see Lal kind of develop as a, even though she's sort of fully developed biologically, for lack of a better word, you know, she still has to kind of develop from infancy onwards. We get to see that development, whereas the Doctor has kind of a prefab family that's already, you don't get to see the development.
The way I kind of saw this was I thought that it was an interesting contrast that we see that, although obviously Data learns things as he's teaching Lal, she's more learning from him and from her surroundings and everything else, whereas I feel like with the Doctor, it's the other way around. He's learning from the family. You know, they're already like doing their thing and they're what they are, and he's learning from them. He's kind of picking up what it's all about to be a father and to have a family and stuff from them. And they don't, I don't know where they really learn a lot from him, but maybe Jeffrey, I don't know.
Frankly, to me, the offspring is a little saccharine. You know, Lal is sweet and she's trying to be like Data and she's learning and she's kind of innocent, and then it's sad at the end. It's really a syrupy episode, even though there's some interesting deep philosophical stuff going on, whereas the Doctor's episode is not saccharine.
She wasn't all that innocent when she attacked Riker and was all making me kiss, which I don't blame her. I would do the same thing.
I guess what I'm saying is I would like to have seen a slightly different version of that episode that's a little more like what we get in Voyager. I would like to see a rebellious Lal.
You
want to
see her acting
like to
see, out a little bit more.
I would like to see the Lal that chose to be a Klingon male instead of a human female.
Oh, a friend for Worf.
Friend for Worf.
Why does Troy say that? I was like, really? Of all the things? A friend for Worf.
So I'm kind of, I can imagine a different version of The Offspring where she chose to be a Klingon male and she ends up acting more like Jeffrey.
Yeah. Yeah, and it would have been interesting, I think, but I guess it depends on what the object of the episode was, because I think with the Voyager episode, I think it's more a case of the Doctor learning about what it is to have a family and kind of getting that sense of everything isn't just as straightforward as that, you know, and often it's the messy stuff that's the stuff that makes everything worth it and makes everything interesting, and the fact that it's unpredictable. Whereas I think with the Data episode, they were more going towards the ethics of it and Captain Picard being torn between, well, this is his child and he's got the right to do this as a sentient being, versus Starfleet research. They want to take her away, etc., because of the benefits that it can bring to them. So I think the focus of the episode being different kind of informs that a bit, because I think if she was acting out, it adds an extra element to the episode that they weren't really going for.
You know, I think as much as the Doctor says he's trying to learn about humanity and real emotion, you know, it's still kind of a performance for the Doctor, right? You know, he sets up a little I Love Lucy scenario and he walks in, honey, I'm home. And, you know, it's an acting gig, you know, it's theatrical. It's like one of his operatic performances.
Yeah, I do agree with that. But I also think it is just a fundamental misunderstanding of his of the way that things like that work. I think he thinks that that's how families are. And so that he creates that and he doesn't see anything wrong with it until B'Elanna comes along and she... I just love it at dinner when she's just like, computer freeze program, what the hell is this?
That is one of the best B'Elanna moments in all of Voyager.
What is this? What is this Stepford nonsense? Come on, get yourself a proper family. This is nothing like how it would actually be.
Do you think B'Elanna modeled Geoffrey after herself? Was she the rebellious Klingon when she was younger? Is there a little bit of young B'Elanna in her characterization of Geoffrey and maybe Geoffrey's friends?
I don't know, because I think she hated being Klingon, didn't she?
Yeah, she hated her Klingon heritage, so she rebelled against that. So possibly she just switched it around and had Geoffrey rebel against his human heritage.
Yeah, I didn't think about it that way, actually. That's quite an interesting point. Obviously, she knows stuff about Klingons, and then it's easier for her to put that stuff in there, so...
The Doctor's two children, Geoffrey and Belle, you have, you know, Belle, who's really sweet, but, you know, she has some behavior issues. But then we get Geoffrey, who's rebellious. You know, if you put those two together, that's like a little microcosm of B'Elanna's internal struggle.
Yeah, I guess. That's an interesting way of looking at it. Because Belle, obviously, she has this risk-taking idea, which, well, I mean, we see...
B'Elanna has.
We see, yep. B'Elanna, you know, play that out. I mean, obviously that becomes more of an issue with her with certain things that have gone on. But I mean, that's obviously something that's in her. And then as well, you know, the Klingon side, the sort of the fiery side, the sort of rebellious side. So yeah, that's a very good point, actually. The influences that B'Elanna's put in there.
See, now I'm kind of wondering, like, what would happen if it wasn't B'Elanna who called BS on the Doctor's, you know, idealistic family? What if it was Chakotay? What if it was Tom? What if it was Harry Kent?
Chakotay.
Like, what family life would they have come up with?
If it was Harry, he would not have done, because that is how Harry's family is. It's all like, beautiful baby Harry, he's so perfect.
Make sure you practice your clarinet, Geoffrey.
Yeah, exactly. Geoffrey. It wouldn't have changed. It would have been exactly the same.
Now, why didn't B'Elanna include the Klingon romance novel in there somehow?
Oh, I know. I love that that comes up in this episode.
Yeah, that's actually a deleted scene. Geoffrey in his bedroom is sitting there reading a little Klingon romance novel. Tears streaming from his eyes.
Yeah. It's quite funny, actually, because that Klingon romance novel scene with B'Elanna and Tom, that's actually the only interesting thing that happens outside of the Doctor's Hollow program.
Oh, I know. I could so do without that B plot.
The B plot in this episode is just so boring.
It is.
It's just like so meh, nothing. I don't even remember it. Like,
yeah, I don't remember how it ended. And it was just like, meh.
Tom goes into Shotland, does something, and his nose bleeds. I don't know. That's about it. The rest of it just instantly leaves my head because there's just nothing about it.
Yeah. It's like, why was it there?
Yeah.
One thing that I thought was a little strange, and I never thought about this until I rewatched both episodes again, I was really kind of struck at how whitewashed the episodes are, you know, especially the Doctor's family. It's like he accessed the Aryan database and created a family. I just, it's so stereotypically white, middle class.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that jumps out at you guys too? I was just surprised at how incredibly... whitewashed, for lack of a better word, and Data too, really. I mean, Data's, you know, he creates a white, you know, Anglo-American female instead of a Klingon, instead of an Andorian. You know, we get to see the whitewashed version. And it's struck me as odd.
Well, with the Doctor's family, it came across as very 90s sitcom to me.
Yeah.
Even kind of what they were wearing was very 90s sitcom.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I joked about sort of Stepford or whatever, but I think that is definitely the kind of thing that they're trying to go for. So whether that's like a conscious thing that they thought about, or whether that's just what, you know, that's who they ended up with for what they were going for, I don't know. But the Next Gen one, I agree. I think it's interesting that they had this idea that she could choose her own appearance and stuff, and that's what she went for. I mean, maybe some of that influence was the fact that she obviously latched onto Troy quite quickly. So maybe there's obviously some sort of modeling herself there, because she was like, I want to look like you, you know. No, that would be confusing.
But even Counselor Troy, when Counselor Troy has a chance to say, well, you know, you don't have to look like me. You can look like a Klingon. You can look like an Andorian. Or you can look like that hot young guy.
Yeah, what even was that?
Oh my gosh, that was just creepy on Troy's part. It's like,
we got a little window into Counselor Troy's psyche.
There's a deleted scene from this episode as well, which is after, like, they've gone away, Troy going back and going, computer, just save that hologram. I want to go meet him again later.
Troy Lambda 3.
Yeah, exactly.
She's been hanging out with Riker too much, picking up his bad habits.
She's in Barclay's program dressed as the goddess of empathy, and she's just got the guy coming up. She's like, ooh.
Yeah, I mean, Troy is so funny. She's like, oh, no problem with social interaction there.
Certainly not with you, anyway. I have no idea what that was all about. Yeah. It was quite funny.
But then Data would have to say, you know, Counselor Troy, what are your intentions with my son?
That is true. Oh, gosh, that scene is very funny.
Well, I guess there's a parallel. If Lal can choose to identify as any species she wants, she can choose her appearance. What's wrong with Geoffrey choosing to identify as a Klingon?
Well, yeah, and I mean, that is where the Doctor gets to after a while, isn't it? Because he sort of, he tries to lay the law down and say, oh, you can't have these friends, and then his wife and his son are like, well, you can't tell me who I can be friends with, you know. And she's like, it's a bit unreasonable for you to tell him who his friends are. And then later on we see him going back and he's sort of like, right, lads, let's sit down, I want to get to know you. I'm just like
and I love when he calls the wife over, he kind of says, come talk to me in private, and he says, you know, I expect you to kind of back me up and be on the same page. And she kind of says, this conversation is over.
Yeah. She just totally closes him down. She's like, well, if you didn't talk, make to the unilateral hand decisions about everything.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, I think I would have liked to have seen them have a conversation, just the two of them, about what they were going to do moving forward. That would have been quite interesting, but we don't see that. Him realizing that, actually, you know, don't treat me like one of the children. But yeah, he does realize towards the end of the episode that actually he's just got to respect them for who they are. He doesn't get to decide who they are. They decide that, and he has to support them and guide them in that.
And I think that's a lesson for all of us, right? Yeah. We all need to just take other people as who they are. So many times we try to make people either into our vision of what people should be or some sort of ideal. This whole thing is kind of a metaphor for life in general. We all need to take people as who they are.
Oh yeah, I mean, I think everybody in both of these episodes learns a lot from both of these two.
Yeah,
I mean, it's sad that they both have to end really tragically and so similarly as well. Which, before we actually started watching these episodes to do this, I hadn't even realized how close the parallels are at the end.
I think it's frustrating because I would love to have seen an alternate version of Star Trek TNG with Lal being an ongoing character, if, you know, if she didn't die. I would love to have seen the Doctor with an ongoing holographic family. The problem is, I think, you know, both of those characters already suck up a lot of screen time, right?
Yeah.
Can you imagine if they introduced Data and Lal, TNG would become the Data and Lal show. And same thing with the Doctor. It would be the Doctor's holographic family show. And I think they rightly didn't want to commit to that.
No, but I think it would have been nice if a couple of times, you know, as the seasons went on, particularly in Voyager, if we'd seen, you know, his wife and his son popping up every now and then. It would have been quite a nice idea. If it's just an occasional reference, I don't think that takes up too much time or time away from anything else.
I can kind of picture it now. Daddy, can I please borrow your holo emitter so I can go to the aeroponics bay?
Well, it wouldn't be Daddy at that point because, you know, she died. I don't think Geoffrey calls him Daddy.
I guess not.
Could you imagine Geoffrey hanging out with Icheb? That would be an interesting combination.
Yeah. I feel like, though, it would be interesting to see how Geoffrey changed, you know, after what happens at the end of the episode, because obviously at that point we see him when the chips are down. He's there for the rest of the family, and I think that reflects a lot on who he is as a person, and I really liked that. That was actually one of my favourite things about this episode, seeing him come in and be there with the rest of the family. That was really nice.
And bring her blanket. Oh.
Yeah. And he calls her Squirt, which I thought was cute. It was cute. I just really liked how there was this obvious dynamic in such a short period of time, and it does seem a shame that we didn't see that more developed.
Well, real families are like that too, though. They squabble amongst themselves, they have sibling disagreements, whatever, but when there's a crisis, when someone's in pain, then people kind of circle
rally
the
around
wagons and come together.
Yeah
yeah
but sometimes they don't.
So do you think it was even though B'Elanna is trying to introduce some tension into the Doctor's family, do you think at the end of the day, he's still kind of got an easy way out at the end of it? Even though the daughter dies, it's still kind of a Sacker and everyone come together moment. And that doesn't always happen in real families. Would it have been better if the Doctor had to deal with an even harder to deal with family?
Dude, that was not an easy way out. His daughter died.
I thought that moment at the end of that episode was just... You could watch that scene over and over again. There's just so much to take from that. You know, the three of them just hugging at the end. And his expression, gosh, Robert Picardo is such a genius. He really is. He's incredible. Absolutely incredible actor. I just felt like at the end there, when they're holding each other and you see his face and you get the close up, and that's the closing scene, is the close up of his face. For me, that the point of that is just the look on his face shows you everything that he has learned as a result of this episode. It just goes, this is the progression of what he's been through, and you see on his face at the end there, he's got it. He gets it now. He didn't get it to begin with when B'Elanna wanted to reprogram them, but now he gets it. And mm-hmm. that is why I love the way they ended that.
Yeah. Oh, see, man, you guys are going to make me cry.
Good, because I bawled my eyes out.
I know. I did cry quite a lot. I cried at both of them, actually, but I think real life made me cry more.
Yeah, I think you're right. For me, even though The Offspring is overall a sweeter, more saccharine episode as a whole, I think the emotional impact of the end of real life is stronger for me for some reason.
Well, I think it's always going to be because the Doctor feels it and Data doesn't. That's the difference.
But the fact that Data doesn't feel it upsets me even more. And I actually cried more with The Offspring than I did with real life.
Right. Yeah.
Because I felt so bad that Data just couldn't grasp exactly what he lost.
Yeah, well, yeah. And I get the same feeling about that episode at the end as I do about the episode where he's trying out dating. And then they break up at the end.
Absolutely. That's one of my favorite episodes.
He doesn't get it. He just goes, oh, I'll just delete my subroutine or whatever. You know, that's like, I get the same feeling there. There's like this melancholiness about him, about the fact that he's missing it. He's not getting the point. He's missing the point. And that's almost sad in and of itself. So I do get what you're saying there. But in terms of how much I feel for them in the moment, the Doctor's obviously like just distraught.
I sort of feel like Data, after he gets the emotion chip, would be a total emotional wreck. Like he would have just like, he would start bawling over Lal, and he would cry over his old girlfriend.
Yeah.
He'd be a mess.
It would suddenly all hit him like really quickly. In the same way that it does with Lal, when she's just like, she can't process the fact that she suddenly started to feel things.
Mm-hmm.
When she walks in with sort of Counselor Troy.
That's an amazing scene.
It's like, oh man, yeah, she's just struggling with everything she's feeling.
Yeah, and she's like hitting herself like in the stomach because, you know, obviously that's where she feels it and she can't process it. It's just so beautifully acted. Yeah.
I do have to say, though, that every time I see The Offspring and see Lal, it just reminds me of Lizzie McGuire because she was the mom in Lizzie McGuire.
Okay. I haven't seen that.
I was going to say, there's somebody in The Offspring that I get a chuckle at every time I watch, because it's Judy Ann Elder. She plays the teacher, Lal's teacher. And she was in one of my favorite movies, Forget Paris. She was the nurse at the infertility clinic. So every time I see her, I'm like, I just start giggling.
I don't remember seeing any of the characters that play the Doctor's family. I don't know whether I see any of those actors in anything else. I don't remember.
I think I've seen the wife in something, but I can't remember what.
I don't remember.
That's your homework assignment. Go watch the Lizzie McGuire movie and pay attention to the mom, which is Lal. So
probably very different.
Or watch Forget Paris if you want to laugh really, really hard, because that movie's amazing.
I shall put them both onto the list.
It's got Billy Crystal. You can't go wrong.
So I think we've probably got to bite the bullet at some point and talk about the endings. It's tough. But like, it struck me so much how the Doctor's sort of talking about his daughter and saying, oh, you know, she's her brain's failing and she's sort of got all these hemorrhages and stuff. And every time we stop one, another one starts. And it's almost exactly the same thing that Data says about Lal. And it's just like, without actually watching these two episodes one after the other, you'd never realize that. Because it's not something you'd particularly remember. So that just really struck me, having watched the two of them together, how that was really strong parallel. And the way it all happens at the end, they were just so closely mirroring one another.
And they both have this amazingly like desperate paternal attempt to save their respective children, yeah. Right? I mean, they're Data's, you know, hands are flying on the console, and the doctor's, you know, doing whatever he's doing in the brain. And
well, they're really desperate, because it's not just the fact that their offspring is dying; it's the fact that they're the ones that have failed to save them as well, the two of them, and that's a really strong parallel. It's just harsh.
I mean, and you'd think the doctor would be used to that. As the doctor, he's lost patients before, but it's different when it's someone you care about.
Yeah.
I mean, even though Voyager as a whole is a family, he cares about all of them, but it's different than someone he's chosen to identify as his daughter.
Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, it's just, it's hard because, I mean, this is just a truth of human existence that, you know, life comes and it goes and people come and go and you try your best to help and save them and find some meaning of it all here in the moment. And
yeah.
At the end of the day, it never feels like it adds up. And I think that's, for me, that's one of the most important insights. At the end of the day, it doesn't all make sense. You know, the daughter's death in Voyager doesn't make sense, and Lao's death in TNG doesn't make sense. Here in the real world, it never makes sense. And that's just a brute force fact of human existence.
Yeah, and I think that actually links into a really important question that I have about something that these two episodes bring up, which is something that Data actually says in The Offspring, which is that Lal asks him why it is that he sort of tries to emulate humans when, like, obviously human life is messy and painful and all the rest of it. And he says, it's the struggle that's important. It's the struggle and the difficulty and the things that you go through. That's where you find the growth. And that's a really important thing that I think we can take from both of these. In real life, we see what the Doctor's created at the beginning. And, you know, that's all well and good. He's got his nice little family and he's all happy with it and he thinks there's nothing wrong with it. But as B'Elanna says when she comes along, you know, with that, you're not going to learn anything. You're not going to learn anything. And it's by making it difficult and making real life struggles part of it that makes it worth it. That's where the learning comes from. And we really see that, I think, in both of these episodes.
Well, not to go all Metatrexian, you guys, but is the learning worth the pain? Is it worth the? I mean, in the Doctor's case, he's kind of created a life, and it ends. And same thing in Data's case, he sort of brought a new life into the world, and it's more like plausible, like a real life. In the case of Lao, I think, because she's a genuinely sentient like Data, and then that life ends. Is the learning and the struggle worth the pain? It's like one of the fundamental questions of our existence.
I was going to say, you could just ask that about life in general, couldn't you? You know,
absolutely.
You know, we could get insanely deep and philosophical here and say things like, well, you know, when ultimately it's all going to end, what is the point? You know, but the point is the experience that you have along the way and the growth that you have along the way and what that growth allows you to contribute. As Data says to Lal, you know, she actually asks him, what is the point of my existence? Why am I here?
I love her metaphysical questioning.
Yeah, when she's just like bombarding why, questions. Quick fire, bang, 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 bang.
I like why she questions why they only have two hands.
Yeah.
That's a good question. One of three, one of four.
I love that.
She's
bit.
Like a 2-year-old that just learned how to ask why.
Yeah, like, why? But yeah, and I mean, I really like Data's answer, which is, well, there aren't any easy answers to that question. But what I think is that it's to be able to contribute in a positive way. Whatever way you can contribute positively, that's the way to do it. And I really like that answer because I think there aren't any easy answers, but that's almost like an easy answer.
it's kind of a non-answer though. It's like contribute positively. Well, what does that mean?
Well,
right?
It means different.
That could mean a thousand
different
things,
which is why the answer isn't easy.
I love that he's like, clearly you just downloaded your metaphysical and epistemological subroutines.
I just love the way they both grow. I feel like they've both grown as characters as a result of these two episodes. Individually, you feel like there's something more to them, especially because, you know, at the end, Data's like, well, I've downloaded Lal into my head, so I've got her in there.
I do think the contrast between these two episodes totally represents the contrast between TNG and Voyager in general, right? In TNG, it's like, okay, you're a fully developed human when you can ask philosophical questions, when you can play classical music and tend forward. And in Voyager, it's like, no, you're a fully developed human when you can, you know, have family struggles and your son wants to be Klingon.
Deal with your son wanting to be Klingon.
Totally. It's a totally different set of issues that define those two shows.
Well, yeah, and I think with Voyager, there is a lot more struggle. I see a lot more struggle. They're in a much more difficult situation. TNG, it's largely airbrushed. You know, yes, they have episodes where there's danger and stuff, but largely speaking, everything's pretty much okay. And also, I feel like all the characters in TNG feel pretty perfect, whereas in Voyager, there's a lot more flaws. You see a lot more sort of flaws and growth in the characters in that sense. You know, and I really love what we get from Tom, which is when he says, well, you know, it's the struggles that we've gone through and the people that we've left behind and the fact that we share that and the fact that we've struggled together is what makes us as a crew into a family. And he just hits the nail on the head for me, I think, as to why, although all the crews feel close to each other in all the shows, for Voyager, it feels like a family more than any of the others. And he just really hits that for me perfectly and explains why that is.
Well, at the very end of, not to make this about TNG, but at the very end of TNG, not the show, but I'm thinking of the end of Nemesis, you know, Riker basically walks into Captain Picard's ready room, shakes his hand, and they're fundamentally colleagues. They're not, you know, there's a family-like component to it, but they're willing to shake hands and walk away at the end of the day. And Voyager, I don't get the sense that that's how they roll. They become a genuine family.
Yeah, and it's because of the struggle that they've been through, because I feel like the TNG crew, whilst there are difficult things that they do go through, it's not a daily struggle in the same way as it is for Voyager. And so I think the bonding that inevitably comes from, you know, it's like the war comrades kind of level of bonding, isn't it? You know, you go through so much together and you automatically end up bonding because of it.
Yeah, I can't see Chakotay walking into Captain Janeway's ready room and shaking her hand and say, it's been a pleasure serving with you, and that be the end of the story.
No.
Right? That doesn't ring true with Voyager.
Definitely not.
People are going to be like, that To the Journey show is a real downer.
We can talk about serious stuff too. It's not just the lol show. That's the thing. It's like, I'm cool with being the lol show, but, you know, I don't want people to think that we're just a lol show.
Seriously, you know, we love Voyager, and a lot of the times on To the Journey, we laugh and we joke and we take pot shots, and there's a lot to laugh at in Voyager, and we're really laughing along with Voyager, but really, we love Voyager. We love these characters. I think we do feel the Doctor's pain in this episode, and no, we don't have to laugh it up every episode of To the Journey. This is a serious episode, and, you know, there's some serious issues to be discussed.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there are actually probably more episodes of Voyager where I either cry at the end or I'm sort of like, I feel like I've been really punched in the feels at the end than there are in any of the other shows.
I don't know if I've watched The Next Generation so much that the emotional impact doesn't hit me as hard anymore, because I've seen all the episodes, you know, 100, 200 times. I mean, I grew up with The Next Generation in a way.
Yeah.
I mean, I was 9 years old when it came out, so that's what I grew up watching. And Voyager, I had to discover. I still feel like I can feel the novelty of the emotional impact in Voyager episodes in a way that the TNG episodes, even the ones that really do pack an emotional punch, I've become numb to them.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that so much. I mean, there are still a few TNG episodes that really do get me, but yeah, I think a lot of the TNG stuff, it does feel a lot less fresh in that way, because I watched them so much when I was a kid, particularly certain ones. I mean, like Encounter at Farpoint, I think I must have watched it like 300 times.
I think what I need to do, I need to do like an actual Star Trek The Next Generation rewatch, which I have not done in a long time.
Well, we should do that together, actually, Zach, because when I finished the original series, which I'm on at the moment, and I've got like a season and a half left, I'm going to go back and do a TNG rewatch. So we should totally do that together and like tweet it or something.
I do put it on from time to time. It's not like I ignore. It used to be my favorite show, so it's not like I ignore it. I do put on, but I skip over some episodes, and I, you know, skip over whole seasons in some cases. And, you know, I really just need to, like, get back into the mindset of Star Trek: The Next Generation. You know, I've been in the Voyager mindset now for 10 years, but, you know, it's a gestalt shift for me. Like, getting into the world of TNG is something I would have to make myself do again.
Yeah, I mean, all the shows do feel fundamentally different, but they really do still feel like part of a whole for me. And I feel like the more I've watched all of the other shows and watched the different ones and how the sort of storylines and the back history and everything interrelates with each other, the more I find it difficult to separate them. They're separated by the fact that we're focusing on different characters, but the universe as a whole, for me, you know, I find it a lot harder these days to say, oh, this is my favorite. I have favorite episodes and favorite characters rather than a favorite show, because they don't really exist in a vacuum for me anymore. I can't really think of one without thinking of the others and how they relate to each other.
Do you think it's a little harsh to say, even though Voyager is my favorite Star Trek show at this point, do you think it's a little harsh to say that TNG aims a little higher in terms of high ideals, and all of the storylines and the drama revolve at this sort of higher intellectual nobility level that Voyager does sometimes, but the soul of Voyager is not at that ultra high shooting over the fences nobility level that the Next Generation has?
I think that Next Gen probably hits it more often, but I would say that Next Gen's got its fair share of hilarious episodes.
Yes, it does.
You know, there's definitely some real funny ones in there that definitely don't aim for any kind of intellectual high whatsoever.
Kay, I protest. I am not a merry podcaster.
Exactly. You are not a merry podcaster. Well, not tonight, you're not anyway.
I know. Well, you brought me down. You suggested this topic and now I'm all depressed. So
yeah, I'm a terrible person. I'm just thinking about the very first episode of Next Gen that I ever saw. In fact, the very first episode of Star Trek that I ever saw, which was The Naked Now. I mean,
really?
Yeah.
Well, that's ridiculous.
Yeah. Exactly.
Oh, I wish
ridiculous.
They had done that a few seasons later.
I think I find it difficult to be objective in talking about that episode because that's where I fell in love with Star Trek. That was the episode I saw that made me go, I really love this show. I want to watch more of it. That I find it hard to be objective about it because I'm so emotionally attached to it as an episode, even though it is absolutely bonkers.
That episode cracks me up, but I really wish they would have done it maybe season 4.
Yeah.
Season 5, when you really knew
the
characters.
Yeah, yeah.
And saw how outrageous they were acting.
Yeah, absolutely.
Since we don't get a chance to talk about The Next Generation on To the Journey all that often, I'm just going to throw this out there while we're talking about it. My first memory of The Next Generation has to do not with the show itself, but with LeVar Burton on Reading Rainbow showing a tour of The Next Generation sets and where he sat on the bridge way back in the first season.
Wow.
And that's my first memory of The Next Generation before the actual show. And you're like, what's Reading Rainbow?
No, I know. We didn't get that over here in the UK. Because you guys told me before what Reading Rainbow is, but I have not seen it, apart from the clips that you've sent me from YouTube. I mean, we got TNG a few years later than you guys. I think the other shows, you know, we sort of got them a bit more in parallel, but TNG we didn't get until 1990, which is about 3 years later, I think, than it was actually first broadcast in the US. So, and I'm glad for that, actually, because I think if it had been broadcast at the same time, I'd have been a bit too young to appreciate it. So coming to it at age 8 rather than age 5, I think. But yeah, it grabbed me from day one, really. I've been a Trekkie since the first time I saw it, really.
Well, to bring things back to talking about the Offspring versus real life, what do you think each of the two characters, Data and the Doctor, took away in the long run? How do these episodes inform their overall character development story arc? Anything beyond what we've already talked about?
I think with the Doctor, he wants everything to be very neat and tidy, which is interesting for a Doctor, because, you know, there's nothing about medicine that's neat and tidy, but there's just this sense about him that he wants everything to be like neat and tidy and straightforward, and to be able to put things into a box and to be able to have everything work the way he wants it to work. And I think this episode teaches him that things can be messy and yet they still have value, and that he learns that actually there's value in things not always going the way you want them to go, and there's learning to be had from things not always going the way you want them to go.
It reminds me of that episode with the psychopathic hologram on the other ship, where at the end of that episode, the doctor's like, a little clutter is okay. And he throws the hyperspray on the ground.
Yeah, that episode is creepy. A little mess creepy. Is okay. Revulsion?
Revulsion sounds right, I think.
Revulsion. It's the super, super duper creepy one that just makes your skin crawl, isn't it?
Yes, it's creepy.
So yeah, that's what I think the doctor learns from that one. And then Data, I think... I find it interesting to think about how, since he's now got Lol in his head, and obviously she was exceeding him in some ways, she was sort of feeling emotion and all the rest of it, I wonder how that manifests itself. I wonder how he perceives how she felt, whether he can do that, or whether it's just purely the sort of flat experience without the emotion.
I don't know. Again, it's an interesting thread that was never really explored. I mean... Data's development is kind of steady and progressive. He doesn't progress in leaps and bounds until he gets his emotion chip.
No.
In the way of kind of bringing our discussion to a close, you two are the ones that these episodes really seem to speak to. You guys were both moved to tears in the episode. And for me, I kind of get a gentle tug at the heart, but I don't get moved to tears. What is it about these episodes that really just speak to your fundamental core beings?
I think it's just that sense of, you know, these characters who are, they're artificially created, and I think we're hitting somewhere here on the line between where they are just a piece of technology and where they're actually a person, and I think that's where the connection really comes for me. That's where I really feel like it hits me, because it proves, it's almost proof in a way that, you know, there's more to these two pieces of technology, for want of a better way of putting it, because that is what they are. You know, they're artificially created. They're not, you know, biological beings in the same way as all the other crew that we see on all the other shows. And they feel closer. And I think the fact that we can identify with the loss with both of them in the same way as we would with a human, That really nails it for me, I think. Well, it's been fun talking about fake families today, but this isn't the only thing we've been discussing on the network. So here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Melodic Treks.
Maybe we could even get a whole other episode of Melodic Treks out of it at some point. Mm-hmm. More highbrow approach for a more... dignified listeners.
We'll drink our Earl Grey and maybe have a cigar, and I would like some scotch.
Yes, and don't forget the Grey Poupon.
Oui, oui. Pardon me, do you have any Grey Poupon?
Saturday Morning Trek. The line that I thought was really interesting, twist me Wittershins, mean a direction contrary to the sun's course, considered as unlucky, counterclockwise. So instead of saying, twist me counterclockwise, they said, twist me Wittershins.
So they use the word Wittershins?
Wittershins.
That's a word?
Yes.
That's
that apparently
a real world.
A child in 1973 should have known, apparently.
Wow. That is, I missed that, and I don't ever want to hear the word. It's a terrible word. It's a terrible word.
Literary Treks.
I do have to say, this one shot, this one full page shot of the Enterprise in orbit of this world with these nuclear explosions going off all over the surface. As far as, you know, you can pick little parts about, you know, the ship maybe not looking quite right or a little cartoony or whatever. This is a gorgeous shot. I think this is beautiful.
The Ready Room.
Well, Larry, you know, in this case, in the writer's room, the real question on Discovery right now is to hoof or not to hoof.
Oh, no. Well, my thing is to three-finger or to five-finger. So,
right. Yeah. What will they do with the Tellarite hand?
I mean, the Klingon forehead's got an example, an answer. When are we ever going to have a reason for what happened to the five-fingered Tellarites versus the... Yeah.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out all these shows and join the conversation about your favourite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You will find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on iPhone, iPad or Apple TV, or the desktop iTunes app to get the latest episode as soon as they're published. And please leave us a star rating and written review. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud and Windows Phone, and also in most third-party apps. Plus, you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link.
We'd love to hear your thoughts on today's show, and there are many ways for you to do that. The best place to join in the larger conversation is the Babel Conference, our listeners-only group on Facebook. Just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it should come right up. If you'd like to send us an email, you can use the form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Choose Send to a Show and select To the Journey. That will come right to us. You can also find the network on Twitter at TrekFM and on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. So, okay, if people would like to know what your favorite Klingon romance novel is, where can they contact you?
Well, they can find me in the Babel Conference. And if they would like to look me up on Twitter, my handle there is ChocoWeeble. So, Zach, when you're not preparing for the cutlet ceremony, where can our listeners find you?
Well, you can find me elsewhere on Trek FM as co-host of Metatrek's Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy, along with my co-host over there, Mike Morrison. You can always find me in the Babel Conference if you want to talk about Star Trek and Voyager with me there. And you can find me on Twitter. My handle is just my name, at Zachary Fruhling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, Fruhling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. And Suzanne, when you're not brushing up on your metaphysics and epistemology, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
Well, you can find me occasionally lurking in the Babel Conference. You can also find me on Twitter at KJaneWay8. That's letter K, Janeway, and the number 8.
Well, if you'd like to help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week, you can become a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, to get all the details. Perks include early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and more, available through our special patrons website, Patron Zone. It requires a great deal of money to produce, host, and distribute these shows each month. We really appreciate any support you can give us, and we hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm.
We'd like to take this moment to thank the people that are instrumental in bringing To the Journey to you each and every week. First off, the founder and publisher of Trek FM, C. Brian Jones. Our executive producers, Matthew Rushing and Kenneth Tripp. Aaron Harvey, our art director. Richard Marquez, our production manager, and Brandon Shea Metella, our Patreon manager. I'd also like to extend thanks to our associate producers, Bruce Lish, Ju Kim, and Richard Marquez. Thanks, everybody!
So join us next week when we will be creating our very own Stepford family. But until then, this has been To the Journey.